Hi, everyone. I'm Natalie Gochner, and this is Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center and have my good friend Shireen Gourbani on the left.
Hello. And hey, listeners. I feel like I don't know who you are, but I feel like we're friends, too.
I love it. And on the political right, John Dougal.
Hey, it's great to be with you. And it's nice to be your friend.
Friendly show today. We're going to go to Hungary, where Viktor Orban just lost in a landslide, John and Shireen. I think it was more than two-thirds of the vote went to Peter Magyar. Am I saying it about right?
Magyar. Yeah, I think Magyar.
Magyar.
Yeah, I'm not totally sure, but I've heard it a couple times.
But we will slaughter it on this show. There you go.
Well, and we sent our VP over there to kind of campaign for Orban.
Which, just pause for a second. That's strange. It's strange that the vice president of the United States was stumping for a far-right nationalist.
Well,
but
he wasn't just stumping. He called President Trump on the phone while he was there at a rally.
Is that right? Interesting.
Trump could speak to the folks attending the rally.
Yeah.
Well, so the thing that I find so interesting about it is it's 16 years of what some would call authoritarian rule and two-thirds out. I mean, this is a shift, and this is a guy that has been so unfriendly to the European Union. And now we got a center-right guy that's pro-EU, and is it foreshadow something, Shireen?
I hope so. I think this is a really interesting moment, and I just take hope from it. Viktor Orban has been an absolute disaster as a leader. The economy of Hungary has not flourished under his leadership. He has quite aligned views to J.D. Vance and to the Trump administration around anti-immigration sentiment, and that has not really done much for their for their economy or leadership either. There's been a really, I think, grim sense that this kind of authoritarian nationalism was really taking hold, and to see it rebuked is good.
John, have you been to Hungary before?
I have not.
Oh, I've been there. Have you?
I have. For me, it's just sort of a fond memory because I'm in college at the time, and I remember being in Vienna, going to get a visa so that I could take the train and go spend a couple of days in Budapest, and how exciting it was to me to go to an Eastern European country. This is shortly after the fall of the Berlin Wall, but not that far after.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful, beautiful city and country.
Interesting.
Yeah. I was there when I was in the Peace Corps, which was, I was actually just talking about this the other night. It was I participated with a college group of students that were working on Odyssey of the Mind. Do you know about
that? I don't.
Anyway, it's like a educational program across the world, also popular in the Midwest. It seems not that popular here in Utah, but they sent a group to World, and the World competition was in Hungary, in Budapest, and it was truly beautiful,
stunning,
incredible city. A really wonderful experience, and I'm grateful that the people of Hungary pushed back.
Well, and known early in its development, recent development, for being pro-markets as far as Eastern European countries felt. And so anyway, it'll be kind of fun to see.
Supposedly Orban, early in his career, was very liberty-minded, and clearly that changed over time.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that troubled me the most was how much he was embracing Russia. And fighting against Ukraine, and that clearly causes me concerns.
John, I love your use of words there about being liberty-minded. Hadn't heard that. That's nice.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to the blockade.
Okay.
What do we got? We've got
Whose blockade are we talking about?
Yeah, we have the war, you know, being suspended for 2 weeks. We have negotiations occurring. Well, first question for me is, interesting that Pakistan is the one that's convening and sort of, when John, did they become this world leader for this kind of thing?
I don't know, but clearly I think with Iran, there's some way where they've got some connections there that we're willing to trust them versus others.
A European country or something like that?
You wouldn't see the vice president going to North Korea if North Korea were brokering this.
Yeah, yeah. So the talk fall apart, and now we've got a naval blockade effective, you know, this week. Shireen, this
U.S. naval blockade.
Yeah, U.S. naval. This has the makings of some high risk in the high seas.
Yeah, that's right. And I think there are a couple things here. So basically what's happening, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that Trump has announced that we will use our military to further constrain what can go through the Strait of Hormuz. This means that the few ships that have been allowed to pass through, which again are largely not coming, you know, it's not necessarily oil that's coming to the United States, but the constriction of that supply is certainly sending up oil prices globally. Mm-hmm. And if I'm not mistaken, the lead negotiator for Iran in this said, you're going to miss the days of $4 and $5 a gallon gas if this continues. So I think people should really start to prepare themselves for what this means in terms of an escalating crisis around access to oil in, in the global sense.
Yeah. And clearly what's going on is Trump is trying to, you know, strangle Iran to say, we're going to block your oil. It's not going to come out on the market. It's going to be stuck.
And you're not going to get these revenues.
Try and put the pressure on them like he was doing with Cuba, with Venezuelan oil.
So we all know that in the background's China. And we keep hearing, and CNN's reporting, that China's about to deliver new air defense systems to Iran. Wow.
Yeah.
This is like the thing. I said on our show last week I was worried about escalation involving Saudi Arabia, but I mean, I would be even more worried about escalation. If you've got Chinese missile systems hurting U.S. troops, that's a bad look.
Yeah. Yeah. Do we think this is another taco situation? Do we think this is headed for increased disaster?
What do you think, John? Yeah.
Well, I think here's the question. Is Trump going to respond kind of like the way we tell Russia, you know, yes, we're supplying weapons to Ukraine, but we are not in the war. So, or is it going to be the type of thing where it's viewed much more provocatively as China is actively engaging and not just a supplier of munitions?
So Nikki Haley was on the Sunday program. She was asked about U.S. ground troops to go retrieve these, this, you know, fortified uranium, whatever the technical term is for it. She thought that we should do it.
Oh,
and,
wow.
You know, I'm a big Nikki Haley fan.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, Ambassador, you have now just said that you want to go and engage in this really high-risk operation. But she's a hawk when it comes to this. And I think this is the issue in the Republican Party is there's plenty of hawks to go around in the Republican Party.
There's also quite a few hawks.
Yeah, and then there's also plenty of don't get us entangled in foreign wars. And it's probably just ripping the party in two.
Yeah.
But then there's the others that we're trying to straddle the fence saying, you know, we're doves. We don't want to engage. But, oh, we're now engaged and it's been 47 years and we need to just put an end to this.
So you saw who's engaged, you two. Pope Leo.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
First American born pope. And it's gotten to the point where our president is putting out on social his feelings about this pope, essentially saying he wouldn't be pope but for President Trump.
Incredible.
Yeah. And Pope Leo basically saying, hey, I'm going to continue to speak out loudly against the war. I'm not sure about this.
As you would expect a pope to do.
Kind of, but I don't expect my LDS prophet to do that.
Maybe we should.
I know that this is why I say I don't know how I feel about this because what I don't like is I don't like to poison the well for a lot of, you know, diversity of thought and experience and expression. I want religion to be a little bit more pure than politics.
I guess I just have to go back to the central question here, which I always think about that quote, like war is not good for women or children or living things, right? If we are a life-loving, if we're part of a life-loving faith. If we're part of a religion.
It's totally fair, Shireen, because I apologize to say that, you know, I like religion to be pure of politics, because what's more religious than, you know, being peacemakers?
Right.
You know,
than caring for the poor.
Right. And I would say, you know, part of President Oak's, you know, talk at General Conference, when he was talking about loving your enemies, he was even talking about, you know, those engaged in war.
Yeah,
he even mentioned that. It wasn't this broader nebulous sense of enemies. He specifically brought out.
So would I elect a president that would never go to war? I don't think so. There's some things worth fighting about, John, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we're taught in, you know, public finance and public policy, political science, that the number one job of government is national defense.
Right.
Protecting the interests of, you know, your country against foreign. So. Anyway, I get a little uncomfortable with the commingling.
Yeah, I guess I'll just ask. I mean, that raises some questions for me, this sense that, you know, to protect, I think we've been told by the version of the history of this country that we like to tell, that the way that we move towards stability is through war, is through violence.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually believe there is another way that we could be moving towards economic stability, towards a more expansive version of kind of the future, or even just holding on to the country that we have that isn't driven out of violence. And
totally fair.
Yeah.
Well, that's totally fair.
Well, you go back decades, Spencer Kimball talked about too many people love war and the concerns about that.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, keep an eye on this.
I think
this
if you go back to the Pope during World War II, I think there was lots of activities, with the Catholic Church back then.
Yeah.
And you look at the 80s with Reagan and Thatcher and the Pope at the time,
Let's take just a minute and talk about Representative Swalwell, the California gubernatorial candidate that's now suspended his campaign after there's alleged, sexual violence, rape, inappropriate behavior with staffers. I could see this one coming. When you started to see the reports, and then when the Manhattan District Attorney's Office said this weekend that he was going to launch an investigation, I knew this
was done.
That's how I felt.
Yeah. Now, so we are recording a little early this week, a little peek behind the curtains. It's only Monday. I don't think that we've heard that he is suspending his campaign, but he has yet to make
for governor. Yes.
He's yet to make, I would say, a full statement on this, which I look forward to hearing. And what I hope it is taking some real accountability and resigning from Congress. I think he should do that. I will say that this is not the only person who with an alleged history of misconduct of this variety in Congress right now. And there are others, including a Republican representative, I believe it's Tony Gonzalez from Texas, who should also resign or be removed. And I just think that the fact that we can't do this on either side is a sign of the times that we live in.
John, bring us home.
Well, I just had a question because I really haven't been following this. Mm-hmm. Clearly, there's been statements that have admitted to sexual, behavior and the lack of consent has been alleged. But what's the connection between New York and California?
I think that the sexual assault that's been reported was reported by a person living in New York.
Okay. So it took place in New York or something like that? Okay.
Yeah. Well, stay tuned. Let's take a short break and we'll be right back. Natalie Gochner with Shereen Gourbani and John Dougal. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on UPR. We'd love to hear from our listeners like you. If you'd like to send us a comment, email BSOTAPodcast@gmail.com. Once again, that's BSOTAPodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Shereen Gourbani on the left.
John Dougal on the right.
And Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. John and Shereen, there was news this week about, I don't know if it's recorded or what, but during the Doge time earlier this year, they talked about Trump's nuclear plan and they talked about downwinders in Utah. And there's some pretty inflammatory comments here, right? They had a staffer said, hey, they're testing in Utah. I don't know, like 70 people live there. And then another one follows, but there's lots of babies. Well, he's right there. But and then someone said they've been downwind before. And this is why we don't use AI transcription in meetings, because they knew they were being irreverent. Uh-huh. This is offensive stuff, John.
Oh, yeah. Very, very offensive. I'm one of those that favors all of the above energy policy, and I think too often we have, confused and conflated nuclear weapons with nuclear energy, and clearly when it came to nuclear weapons, the United States government was irresponsible, to put it mildly, when it came to testing and putting folks in Nevada and Utah at risk as a result of being downwind of those tests.
Yeah. And I guess I'll just add, as a person who is from a state where there are like 70 people, I take offense because even if there are
that's in the summer.
A few people, I just think this kind of talk, this kind of, discourse coming out of these young individuals who were hired to be part of Doge is par for the course. This is what was happening in those meetings. And I think now you're starting to see some of these individuals being held accountable, being asked, what did Doge do? How much money was saved?
Yeah.
Was there an outcome of this that was associated with what it intended to do? And the answer is no.
It's just a bad memory for me because I think of public service as something that we should honor in our workforce and whatnot. And I think Doge went too far.
Yeah.
But I'm going to say it also is an example of a bunch of 20 and 30 somethings who, I'm sure there are things we have all said when we were in our 20s and 30s that we look back today and go, cringe.
Okay, so we've got CD1. This is the district that is so gerrymandered, Shireen, that a Republican cannot win in it.
Wow.
By design.
Wow. Does anyone know what that feels like in the state of Utah?
Thank you, Prop 4.
Derek Kitchens dropped out of this, and over the weekend, Kathleen Reby exited and actually endorsed former Representative Ben McAdams.
Yeah. Well, first, I just want to give a huge shout out to Senator Reby, who I think proudly serves and represents what Democrats stand for in the state and our state legislature. I'm in some ways happy to see this because it means to me that she'll continue. I mean, she was not up for election this year anyway, but I hope that she continues to serve as an educator, as a straight talker, as a person who gets legislation passed. She works well with her colleagues to get important work done.
I would totally agree, meaning that she's productive, she's very data oriented.
Yes.
And she knows how to build across the aisle observed. I don't know.
Yeah.
John, is that your experience, Senator Reby?
I probably had mixed experiences with Senator Reby over the years.
Well, this is a moment we're celebrating her, so you can keep those to yourself. But I'll just say it's not a surprise to me that Senator Reby would look realistically at what she was facing. And she did say, you know, a huge part of this is that you have to be able to raise just boatloads of money to be in this this line of work. Mm-hmm. And she was having a hard time doing that. I think, you know, time constraints and just everything else, a bit of a crowded field, made this a really reasonable decision. I'm sort of proud of her for making this decision.
Who else do we have here? We have Nate Bluen's in this race.
Nate Bluen's still in it. Obviously, Representative former Ben McAdams. Livon Mohammed is running. I kind of forget who all is in. I think there are many more.
Yeah.
But it's still a crowded field. And I you have to ask, I think, or wonder how long, you know, well, they'll stay in it until the state convention. Only a few people have collected signatures.
Which is what, 2 weeks away for you guys?
Yeah, that's right. So I believe only Nate Bluen and Ben McAdams have the signatures at this point.
Interesting. Hey, John, I know I've heard you before make some comments about Sim Gill, our county attorney.
I am not a fan of Sim Gill.
I
will just state it up front. Don't trust the guy. Well, never will.
So he survived the Salt Lake County Democratic Convention, but barely. He's got a challenger in Sean Robinson. Did you see all these fireworks going down?
No, I did not pay attention to this. So I was not at the Salt Lake County Democrat Convention.
But you're okay seeing Sim Gill take some heat?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
You want to explain that to our listeners or let it go as it said?
I would just say, as my experience as auditor, I saw some behavior that I considered utterly inappropriate and some comments made, and that said, I do not trust him in his office.
I tell you this, I'm a big fan of my father-in-law, and I know he thinks very highly of Sim Gill, so there's something there.
So also a person who has been, I mean, worked closely with him when I was on the county council and have always found him to be a person who does carry the weight of a very difficult office with a lot of thoughtfulness. And I don't always like what he, you know, comes out and does. I think a lot of folks find frustrating how few times it feels like, for example, police have been held accountable for shootings that have happened in our communities. But that's a tough job. And what Sim has said numerous times is that district attorney is a job that everybody thinks they want, but nobody really wants to do. It's a tough role.
Yeah. Okay. So how about this sort of back and forth occurring right now between our Congressman Blake Moore and his opponent, who's Carrie-Anne Lisenby for this Republican seat? Lisenby is going after him for being an early backer of Prop 4. And Congressman Moore, in his commentary, just reminds people that he was in graduate school in 2017 and he wrote a paper on gerrymandering. And he says, you know, that's something, but it's nothing like the power held by the legislature as they've tried to, you know, control this boundary issue.
Yeah, basically do everything they can to ensure that they get to pick their voters and that the voters don't get to pick them.
John, did you see Lisenby's quote on this? It's pretty good. She said, Blake has often sided with Democrats when casting votes on important amendments concerning our civil liberties, the Department of Education, USAID, climate change and spending, but perhaps most egregious was his involvement in Better Boundaries.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think this is going to be one of the friction points that will continue throughout this race. The legislature clearly is very frustrated with Prop 4 as a whole. The results of it, you've got Blake Moore that lives in CD1, running for CD2, which is most of the district that he currently represents. And so he's saying that he's largely sticking with the district that he's been with. but they're trying to make a case. And you don't have to live in your district, but they're trying to say, you know, he lives in CD1. CD1's as a result of his work, and they're going to keep hammering that on and on and on. For some of the delegates, for some of the voters, that's going to matter a lot. For others, they couldn't care less.
Do you think he delivered a gerrymandered seat in the name of anti-gerrymandering? That's what Lisenby's saying.
Well, you know, it depends what your involvement is. But if you go all the way back and say he was involved in Prop 4 and ultimately Prop 4 led to this, then clearly that's her narrative. And you can make that argument. Blake Moore is going to say, I quit my involvement with Prop 4 years and years ago.
Yeah.
So what took place last year, you can't lay at my feet. That was the result.
I would also
and
say,
for other folks, they would say Prop 4 resulted in something that was not anticipated.
Yeah, I would also say, look at his leadership in Congress and look at his leadership position. He's very respected and seems to me to often cut things in a sort of productive, common sense place.
Yeah, I would just, you know, remind listeners that Representative Lisenby is certainly part of the wing of our legislature that when we kind of think about, I would say one of the things I find in common with you, John, is this desire for smaller government. It feels like she is certainly part of a group that has been willing to reach government into the most intimate corners of individuals' lives. I don't think that she's a small government person. I'm curious just about the way that Utahns feel in the way that the legislature continues to just grab power. She's a part and parcel of that. So, you know, are people tired of that, or do they want to reward that kind of overreach into your life?
Yeah.
Yeah. Representative Lisenby's message is going to sell at convention. It's not really going to sell it at the primary.
Right.
So you're going to see something that's going to be different there.
Yeah. John, did you see that Prop 4 lost another Senate district?
Ah, yeah, you were telling me this.
Yeah. So basically, this is to the gerrymandering
issue. It wasn't going
to
get on the ballot because it didn't get 26 of 29
right.
Senate districts, but it's just...
Lost another one.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, and I think, again, what this says to me is I feel the process that we have in place is flawed. It really is. Mm-hmm. And all of the changing of the rules back and forth has created, I think, more chaos for voters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's tough. Hey, we just have just like a minute or so, a couple minutes remaining. Do you guys see that the University of Utah is planning a new Olympic Research Center for Societal Impact? Do you guys see any of this news reporting?
No, but please tell me all about it. I'm very interested.
Do you know anything going on at the U?
Yeah. Well, I only bring it up because it's there's only three of them in the United States, and the University of Utah is well on its way. It's passed
what,
the Academic
what are
Senate.
They?
For it, you know, they're sanctioned by the IOC, and okay. You do research on, in our case, it'll be the economic impacts of major sporting events. It'll be climate issues associated with the winter sports.
Yeah.
It could be ethics issues with anti-doping and just different kinds of, you know, problems in the bid process.
And who else has?
Arizona State, Oregon, you'll like that, University of Oregon, and then another sports university. So we would be the fourth in the country to have it. And I just think it's another fun side effect of the Olympic Games.
I think this is a really, there are so many ways in which hosting the Olympics, you certainly would know better mm-hmm. than I do, has this sort of long-lasting impact on our community. I even think about, I mean, for me, it's like tangible things like tracks and all the housing that mm-hmm. was built up at the University of Utah is a part of it. I hope that we find good ways to communicate broadly why these kinds of investments in our civic culture and in games, right, really matters. And I do think that there's a lot to be learned, and it would be helpful to have better information around what sports, like, for example, talking about what's happening with the Delta Center and kind of the remake of that portion of downtown. I would love to have just better data on this and more universities focused on what really are the right balances between public
like your
and private.
And this is one of those things where I will jump in and say, I'm all for the private sector stepping up and investing however they want to invest. I get skittish and concerned when all of a sudden we start translating that into, okay, the government needs to spend money. The government needs to spend
on
this, spend
on
that, spend on something
there.
Else.
Yeah. But
I know
just,
it doesn't surprise you.
Yeah, I would just say that... the legacy impacts of a world event are something that we should, you know, figure out how to maximize and optimize, right?
Yeah.
And that's kind of your point, Shireen. And John, you want it to be privately funded, which our games have largely been. But we've got an opportunity to secure our standing as an Olympic city in perpetuity.
Even if we don't have snow?
We'll get there.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And I'm just remembering, you know, a business that was so excited for the 2002 Winter Olympics. And they basically had no customers during it.
Yeah.
And eventually went out of business as a result.
Which is a way to say an Olympic Research Center will teach the community that it's not about a 17-day event, but it's about the spotlight the Olympics brings to help you get better in every way.
Yeah.
Okay, great conversation. Program is produced by Anthony Scoma, Shireen Gorbani, John Dougal, and Natalie Gogner. Thanks for joining us.
This episode will be available shortly at upr.org and wherever you get your podcast.